Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the first response to Obama's State of the Union from the Republicans, which is an invitation from Speaker Boehner to Israel's Prime Minister Netanyahu to address the Congress, aimed clearly as a slap in the face to Obama's foreign policy efforts in coordination with the UK, France, China, Russia, and Germany to curb Iran's nuclear program and end its isolation. MJ Rosenberg, who served as the Director of Policy Analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs APAC biweekly publication on Middle East policy, joins us to discuss whether this poke in the eye to Obama will backfire in Israel and hurt Netanyahu's re-election chances. Then we look into the diplomatic opening underway in Havana in talks between the top U.S. diplomat for Latin America, Roberta Jacobson, and her Cuban counterpart, Josefina Vidal, the head of the Cuban Foreign Ministry's North American Affairs Division. William Leogrand, a professor of government at American University and co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana, joins us to discuss the likely outcome of the first talks in 38 years involving a top U.S. official and the Cuban government. Then finally, we will speak with Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University and the author of The New Politics of Inequality and The Age of Austerity. He joins us to discuss his op-ed in the New York Times, Can Capitalists Save Capitalism?, and the emerging inclusive capitalism movement that seeks to make our capitalist system more equitable, more sustainable, and more inclusive. We will discuss elements of inclusive capitalism in the President's State of the Union address and the White House's economic agenda of tax increases on the 1% aimed at bringing about higher medium incomes, lower poverty rates, and broader, more inclusive growth. And joining us now is MJ Rosenberg, who was a special correspondent for the Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to the Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. Welcome to Background Briefing, MJ Rosenberg. So, MJ, no sooner had President Obama finished the State of the Union address, where he warned the Congress not to interfere in efforts to bring about normalization with Iran and neutralize its nuclear program. Right out of the gate, John Boehner, the House Speaker, invites Prime Minister Netanyahu to address the Congress in a clear, unequivocal slap in the face, an insult to Obama. I mean, it's a tragedy that we have such divided government, but normally foreign policy is the president's purview. And usually there's some deference paid, but apparently not anymore.
Well, this is, you know, this is kind of a unique situation. It really it's unique in the worst sense of the word. Boehner and the Republicans invite Netanyahu to address Congress as two things. One, to harden opposition to the president's program on sanctions, hoping they can maybe get the numbers to overturn the president's veto. But I think he's also to send a message to Obama and Democrats that you keep on this course of pursuing peace or an agreement with Iran, and you're going to lose support from pro-Israel donors, the Jewish community. And it's all wrapped up in lots of ugliness, because Netanyahu is not just the head of a foreign country. If the president of France comes here, there is no one thinks in terms of the French American constituency. When Netanyahu comes, the Republicans and some Democrats, particularly those who don't really know the Jewish community, think, oh, here's the leader of the Jewish people. And we have lots of Jews in my district or lots of Jews in my state, and a lot of them give contributions. This thinking is all wrong, but that's part of this whole mix, too, is that it's sending a message that you do the wrong thing on Iran, it's going to cost you political money.
Well, but there doesn't appear to be any regard to the broader picture of global politics and the fact that the P5+1 which is the permanent five on the Security Council at the United Nations, plus Germany. This is most of the advanced world, essentially trying to get Iran to give up its nuclear program and inviting it back into the family of nations, provided it meets a number of conditions. And if the whole world is working on trying to solve this problem, it's embarrassing that it should be scuttled for such petty and punitive reasons.
Well, it's not going to be scuppered or scuttled for that reason, because the president is going to win this battle. But the bottom line is, there's only one factor in this whole opposition. If not for the Netanyahu and his lobby, the president would have a free hand on all this. I mean, remember, I worked in the lobby, so I know how it operates. If it wasn't the lobby and Netanyahu together constitute the only real opposition, and I would say the only serious opposition worldwide to this deal, to an agreement with Iran. People can say, well, what about the Saudis? The Saudi lobby in Congress doesn't exist. There's really no, there are Saudis who, there's a Saudi ambassador, but there's nothing, no pro-Saudi PACs, no pro-Saudi money. This whole thing is about Netanyahu's political power in the United States. But to be clear, we're not talking about power, it's not the Jewish community. It's very wealthy, a few hundred at most, very wealthy donors. But when you're talking about someone like Sheldon Adelson, who gives millions of dollars to candidates and was Mitt Romney's number one, donor, we're talking about some serious money that is directed by, that is earmarked for politicians who toe the line on Israel and Iran. That's the line being the Likud party line.
But MJ, I try to follow foreign policy and national security affairs, and there's a certain level of seriousness. The world's a serious and dangerous place. And the idea that people would meddle with one of the few things that show some progress to stop Iran's isolation, get rid of its nuclear program, and more importantly, diminish the power of the radicals that control Iran, the Revolutionary Guard Corps. And it's worth noting that Israel just fired, an Israeli drone just struck a convoy, killing an Iranian general and the son of the former head of Hezbollah's military wing. The son's name is Jihad, and of course the head of the military wing was Imad Mughniyeh, the infamous Iranian operative who was responsible for the Marine Barracks bombing, the American Embassy bombing, the downing of the Pan Am plane, and on and on and on. So the idea that the IRGC are really, what's happening with the Iran nuclear deal is all to do with domestic politics in Iran. And Rouhani, the so-called moderate, is trying to make the deal, but the IRGC are scuttling the deal as much as they can. And they don't want to be put out of business, because the minute there's normalization, all of that great Satan stuff goes away and they're basically become irrelevant. So they're fighting for their existence in a way, and they control so many of the resources. They have their own military industrial complex. So it's a complicated mosaic. So now that the Hezbollah is now vowing to retaliate, there's likely to be some military action. And again, it leads you back to the idea that it's a serious world, this is serious business. And for these petty politicians who have this burning hatred of Obama and will do anything to screw him up, they don't seem to have any conception of the broader picture of America's role in the world and the importance of trying to bring about peace and get rid of nuclear weapons.
They don't make any distinctions. I mean, Rush Limbaugh said again right before the speech, he said, once again, I wish the worst. I hope President Obama does not succeed. I mean, that old, you know, the line, the adage you quote about politics stopping at the water's edge. I don't know if it was ever really true, but it's certainly not true now. Everything is about politics. And everything is, and maybe politics is the wrong word, because everything is really about raising money from rich donors to advance politically. So, I mean, the idea that these people, that these Republicans and others would have a larger concern for the country. You know, I think about the fact that after 9/11, I, like most of my kind of liberal friends, I supported George W. Bush, and I support. I mean, I'm not saying that with pride, because I now think that I was duped. But the point was, I mean, he's the president. It looked, the United States was attacked, and I remember, on my front lawn, I had 40 little American flags I put up. I had them up for so long, my kids said, "Take them down. They're all raggedy already." Well, it's a whole different mindset. I don't think that people like me ever wish the country ill. You know, we don't say like, "Oh, well, if the country goes down the tube, the Democrats have a better chance of winning the next election." But that's the way the Republicans think. I mean, that's why Obama had to make that point yesterday when he was talking about the economy and how the country is, you know, the economy is expanding. We're doing better than everybody else in the world. And the Republicans start laughing and you know, making noises, unhappy noises. And he says, that's good news, folks, because it's not good news for them. They don't wish the country well. And Israel for them on this is just a tool, you know. It's just like every other issue. It's just there's Israel and there's guns and there's abortion and whatever. And there's this immigration thing. Everything, absolutely everything, is now about, you know, winning the next election and rewarding their donors.
And I suppose this is a perfect deal then for the Republicans and for Netanyahu. He's got an election coming up, so it's a win-win.
Oh, yeah. And of course, for Netanyahu, there's no question that this trip, he would certainly be fighting Obama, and he was fighting Obama on the sanctions anyway. But the trip 6 weeks before his election, you know what's going to happen. If the trip takes place, he's standing up there in the Capitol the way he does. And, you know, he has a very unique way of standing there, which foreign leaders like prime ministers of Britain, for instance, and even Tony Blair never did, which is he stands there in this very relaxed way as if he's the Speaker of the House or something. It's like it's his chamber, and he's very colloquial and American, and he's kissing and hugging everybody, and it's like all to demonstrate, I own these people. I've got control here, Obama, that you don't. They don't all like you, but they all like me. Because the fact of the matter is, his standing ovations that he's going to get, 25 or 43 standing ovations, are not going to be led necessarily or even probably by Republicans. Last time he came and he was taking on Obama, it was the head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was using her hands like a orchestra leader to indicate, okay, now you stand, now you applaud. So this time, you know, this will be the same thing. It'll be Chuck Schumer and Debbie Wasserman Schultz and Lindsey Graham and Ted Cruz, you know, all to demonstrate that although there's no American issue on which we stand as one, we, the Congress, stand on one behind Netanyahu and AIPAC. It's amazing. They didn't even come together as one after, like, Newtown, when American kids were slaughtered. Even a time like that. Nope. They immediately start talking their gun agenda. No, there's nothing. Except the Israel issue, not Israel, the Israel issue, and the money that surrounds the Israel issue, about which these two parties will unite. Absolutely nothing.
And of course, Netanyahu does come across as an American. He spent a lot of time here, and Israel's ambassador to the United States, Ron Dermer, is a former, he's an American, but he also formerly worked as a chief aide to Newt Gingrich, presiding over the contract on America. So
yeah,
his father
was the mayor of Miami Beach.
They're Republican operatives.
These are Republican operatives, essentially.
Right.
If you remember way back when in Netanyahu's first term as prime minister, when Clinton was president, right after the Republicans won with that contract on America in 1994, Netanyahu came here and, it was during the impeachment thing. Clinton's impeachment. He comes here to meet with the President of the United States. He makes his first stop at Speaker Gingrich's office and was allowed himself to be quoted making jokes about the whole Monica Lewinsky thing. And only then did he drag himself to see President Clinton. I mean, he thought that Clinton was going to be impeached and removed from office, so he was playing the Gingrich card. Well, that's what he's doing now. He doesn't think Obama's going to be impeached, but he knows that Obama's down to his last 2 years. That is what I think the significance of that the most likely next president, Hillary Clinton, indicates today that she doesn't stand with Netanyahu on this. She stands with Obama. I'm delighted by it, but I'm surprised, too. It's very good news on this front. As I said, it's telling Netanyahu, don't think you can wait out. You can wait out to the end of this term. The likely next president's going to be the same thing.
So how do you think the fact that Hillary Clinton's come out against Boehner and the Republicans and Netanyahu for trying to undercut Obama's Iran initiative? And by the way, it's not Obama's Iran initiative. It's the entire UN Security Council plus Germany. So how's that going to play in Israel, given that this is a political stunt that meant to help get Netanyahu reelected? Would the fact that Hillary Clinton's come out against him, how would that play in Israel?
I think that I'm hoping too that it'll be exploited by the labor people, the opposition, which right now is ahead in the polls, to show, look, Netanyahu is jeopardizing our relationship with not just with Obama, but with the Democratic Party, and in a larger sense with the United States. Israelis don't like it when anyone endangers that relationship. They know that the relationship is their lifeline. They get $3.5 billion at least from the United States every year. The last time a prime minister strongly challenged a Democratic president was back in 1992 Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir went to war with the first George Bush over the issue of the West Bank settlements. Bush didn't back down, and the Labor Party in Israel exploited it and said Shamir is jeopardizing the relationship with America, and as a result, Shamir lost the next election, and Washington's favorite, which was Yitzhak Rabin, came in. So I think that if Obama plays this right, this can help accomplish what he wants to accomplish, but doesn't want to be seen, intentionally doing, which would be to bring down Netanyahu and bring in Herzog, who's the head of the Labor Party and a relative dove on all these issues.
And what's Tzipi Livni's role? Is she going to be part of that coalition?
She's part of the coalition, but it's a rotation agreement where for 2 years Herzog is the prime minister and she's the foreign minister, and then they switch. So Livni is so, Herzog is truly dovish. Livni, in my opinion, can't be trusted. But her leader for the next 2 years, at least, will be Yitzhak Herzog, which means I think it's going to be, if they come in, it'll be by Israeli terms, a fairly dovish administration, and one that would be very, we get along very well with Democrats rather than Republicans.
Right,
so
but Livni's got those security creds, just like Rabin had security creds being a former general. Livni was a former senior Mossad official.
She does have security creds, but the question is whether she would use them for anything. She tends to be a lot of talk, but in the end, then she winds up, you know, she winds up being as hawkish as any other Israeli on any, you know, foreign policy issue that comes along. So far, there's no evidence that she turned out to be Rabin.
Sure.
But this guy Herzog, if they can pull off the feat of defeating Netanyahu, it will be a very significant thing. I don't believe it's going to happen, but just the idea we even would be talking about it as a possibility is really good news, because that would be almost like a revolution in Israel right now. The right has been so entrenched. What I'm hoping is that this Netanyahu speech to Congress and this offending Obama just blows up in his face. It might not. He assumes it's going to help him. But, you know, it's hard to calibrate these things.
Well, MJ Rosenberg, I thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with MJ Rosenberg, who's a special correspondent to The Washington Spectator and a regular contributor to The Huffington Post. He worked on Capitol Hill for various Democratic members of the House and Senate for 15 years and previously served as the director of policy analysis for the Israel Policy Forum and was an editor of Near East Report, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, APAC's biweekly publication on Middle East policy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the diplomatic openings underway in Havana, Cuba. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Leo Grant, a professor of government at American University and a specialist in Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. He's been a frequent advisor to government and private sector agencies and has written 5 books, including Our Own Backyard, The United States in Central America, 1977 to 1992. And most recently, he's the co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Leo Grant.
My pleasure.
And we spoke recently when you were in Cuba, the very moment when the announcement was made of the breakthrough after this long, dysfunctional and hostile policy towards Cuba and the ending of it by both President Obama and President Raul Castro almost making simultaneous announcements. Now we learn that the talks have just begun in Havana between U.S. Assistant Secretary of State Roberta Jacobson, who's the top U.S. diplomat for Latin America, and her Cuban counterpart, Josefina Vidal, who's the head of the Foreign Ministry's North American Affairs Division. I guess, what does it do? It takes 2 women to settle this 50-year-long dysfunctional policy? Is that what's going on here?
Well, I think that they're going to make good progress. The agenda for the talks in this round is to formalize the establishment of normal diplomatic relations and to begin to talk about some of the issues of mutual interest between Cuba and the United States that have been stuck because of the Alan Gross problem.
And, of course, Alan Gross was quite visible in the State of the Union, where the president said, "We are ending a policy that was long past its expiration date. When what you're doing doesn't work for 50 years, it's time to try something new." I thought that was a pretty succinct way of putting it. How did that strike you?
Well, I think that's exactly the point, and that's the point the president made when he announced this back on December 17th. And the American people seem to agree with him. There have been several national polls that have been done since December 17, and they're finding 60% and more favorable ratings on the change in policy towards Cuba. So I'm not surprised that the president wanted to focus some attention on it last night.
Well, as you've probably noticed, William Lyon-Grand, the Republicans were stony-faced through most of the speech and were petulant and petty and wouldn't applaud, even when he was talking about stuff that's clearly in the national interest. So we know that there's going to be enormous resistance, and it's all but impossible to have full diplomatic relations, because that would require confirmation of an ambassador via the Congress, and that's not likely to happen. So the president is doing what he can in the meantime. So tell me, we know about the resistance on our side. What about the resistance on the Cuban side? What do you know about that?
Well, I don't think there's a great deal of resistance on the Cuban side. No doubt there are some people in the Cuban leadership who worry about, down the road, about a flood of U.S. trade and a flood of U.S. investment and a flood of U.S. tourists that might have the effect of sort of overwhelming Cuba and pulling it back into the kind of dependent relationship it had on the United States before the revolution. But we're a long, long way from that. Tourism is still not legal, and the embargo is still in place, and investors still can't invest in Cuba. So those kinds of issues are still a far way off.
But when the president says, as he did in the State of the Union, our change in policy towards Cuba has the potential to wipe out a legacy of distrust in the hemisphere, remove false excuses for restrictions in Cuba, defend democratic values, and extend the hand of friendship to the Cuban people, how does that strike Fidel Castro, for example, particularly the part about defending democratic values? You know, it's a one-party state, no opposition, no political opposition, no press, you know, basically run by the Castro brothers, and the president saying that we're, you know, maybe it's not a subtext, but it's certainly implicit that we're going to try and defend democratic values. That's always been an absolutely anathema to the Castro brothers.
Well, it's certainly always been U.S. policy, and the president was quite explicit about it. I think what's happened is that the two governments have agreed that they can have a normal diplomatic relationship and engage with one another and discuss these issues in a civilized way, even though on some of them, like this issue of democracy and human rights, they're going to have disagreements. So that's the change. The change is now the United States is going to try to pursue these issues through a policy of engagement rather than trying to coerce the Cubans into submission.
And we certainly know how well that policy has gone. Is it your sense, as many analysts have suggested, that this 50-year-long blockade against Cuba has actually backfired and strengthened the government of the Castro brothers?
Well, there's no doubt that Fidel was brilliant at wrapping himself in the Cuban flag and invoking Cuban nationalism against the United States to rally support around his government. But the embargo hurt Cuba economically, more at some times than at others, and it hurts Cuba today economically. So it makes good sense that the Cuban government now is interested in trying to remove it, especially since Cuba itself is undergoing a reorganization of its economic model. It's a more outward-looking approach that they're taking, one more open to particularly to direct foreign investment and to business in the private sector. So they see in the future that an economic relationship, a normal economic relationship with the United States, is going to be in their interest.
So this idea then that a lot of conservatives in this country have is that as soon as Cuba opens up, it's just going to, the communist system's going to collapse and capitalism is going to triumph. Walk us through the potentials and the pitfalls and how this transition is going to be managed, because some analysts have suggested that if the government were to fall, the Castro government were to fall, there'd be just an extraordinary flood of refugees. Clearly, that's not about to happen. And we've mentioned the sort of the dance, if you will, going on between the U.S. and the leadership in Havana. So how do you think both sides are going to manage this? Nobody wants a collapse except the hardliners on our side. But on the other hand, I would think from the Cuban perspective, they want to be able to manage this transition.
They do. And I think that you know, they have as a model the way in which Vietnam and China changed their economic systems over time from highly centralized planning to a more of a market socialist kind of a model, and normalized relations with the United States as part of that process. So I think the Cubans look to those examples of being able to make some important changes in their economy, being able to improve the relationship with the United States, but also to maintain political control and not let these changes spin out of their control.
Well, I've had friends who've visited Cuba, and I've talked to environmentalists as well about Cuba, and in many ways, Cuba is a model for environmental protection, and there are vast empty beaches and rainforests that are untouched. And I'm wondering whether they will be able to maintain that. And one of the great ironies of the transition that took place, the shock transition, if you will, when the Russians or the Soviets pulled the plug, the Cubans had no energy. Or they had a terrible shortage of gasoline, and they adapted in a very creative and interesting way. And frankly, global warming makes it pretty clear that we and the entire planet needs to get off that drug as quickly as possible. So are there some lessons that we can learn? One, are the Cubans going to just fall victim to consumption, or are they going to maintain some of the gains that they've made in terms of protecting the environment and not overdeveloping?
No, I think they're committed to protecting the environment and to safeguarding what they've preserved thus far. Cuba's an island, after all, so they take the issue of climate change very, very seriously. You know, a rising ocean is a real problem for them. So they have been real pioneers in trying to develop alternative sources of energy. Part of that's because they don't have a lot of petroleum. They only are able to produce about a third of their own petroleum consumption, and so they want to become less dependent on the imports of petroleum, so they've been developing wind and they've been developing solar and so on. So I think the United States will find, when it comes to the issue of carbon emissions and climate change, that Cuba is going to be a very responsible partner.
So you don't see Cuba turning into Miami Beach, which is huge hotels lining the sand?
Well, I hope not. Although Cuba has a very robust tourist industry, to be sure. They hosted 3 million foreign visitors last year, most of them coming from Canada and Spain and Italy. And they would love to host tourists from the United States if we can change the law that prohibits tourism. But they're developing the tourist industry in a controlled way, and I think they do see the value of maintaining some of the pristine areas as, in effect, national parks, if you will.
So is there anything to be read into the low profile that Fidel Castro is taking? And obviously he's no longer the president, his brother is, but you do get the impression that he's sort of staying out of the picture. Is that tactically necessary because there's still such residual animus towards him?
No, I don't think that's it. Everyone was quite surprised that he didn't have anything to say at all about the normalization of relations. It's such an historic development that one would have expected he would have written one of his periodic reflections to be printed in the paper, and he didn't. And so that led to rumors that he had died, which the Cubans have knocked down now. But I think it's probably the case that he's not in very good health, which is why he hasn't made any public appearances in almost a year now.
So is that then he's likely to pass soon? Is that your sense?
Well, I think that Raul Castro has really been in charge now since at least 2008, when he took over the reins of the president himself. Fidel even in his reflections, was always careful to back up the decisions that Raul was making. There's good reason to think that some of those decisions maybe rankled him a little bit because they were very different than decisions that he had made in the past. But if he had disagreements, he kept them private between the two brothers so as to give Raul the broadest authority that he needs to run the system.
So at the State of the Union, John Boehner invited a Cuban dissident who's railing against the agreement and basically saying it's a betrayal. Is there anything that could satisfy the Miami Cubans in terms of this deal proceeding? I mean, the arguments coming from the Miami Cuban opposition is that this is a sellout and that the people that the U.S. and Obama is selling out are the Cuban dissidents who now are totally at the mercy of the Castro regime. That's what they're saying.
Well, that's really nonsense. First of all, the dissident community on the island is of two minds about this agreement. There are some dissidents who have denounced it, and there are others who have welcomed it. There are a number of very prominent dissidents who have said historically that when U.S.-Cuban relations are warmer, they have more political space to operate. The government is more tolerant of what they do. And the idea that somehow we've sold them out and left them at the mercy of the Cuban regime, we weren't doing anything to protect them previously. The old policy wasn't doing them any good. So it's hard to see the logic of that. Now, in terms of the Cuban American community in Miami, that community is also very heterogeneous in its attitudes about this. In fact, a poll that was done shortly after the president's announcement showed that the community was split about 50-50 in terms of support and opposition. And almost all the opposition was from the older, over 65 crowd that came here in the 1960s and the 1970s. But among younger people, among people born in the United States, among people who've come more recently, there were pluralities in favor of the president's policy.
Well, of course, one of the prominent Cuban-American politicians is Senator Marco Rubio of Florida, who's accused President Obama of being the worst negotiator since Jimmy Carter. Of course, Jimmy Carter, by the way, negotiated the Camp David Accords, which are still operating today. What's the likely political trajectory of this, given that you, in the State of the Union, it was so apparent that this country is tragically divided and nothing is really going to get done? Are they just going to rail about this and Obama's going to do what he can and it essentially is going to take a Democratic majority in the Congress to actually bring about full relationships? I mean, how long are we going to have to go on with this?
Well, we're going to see legislation introduced shortly to lift the embargo, to lift the ban on tourist travel, and to simplify agricultural sales. I know that all of those bills are in the process of being drafted, and most of them are going to be introduced by Republicans. Now, the reality is that the majority of Republicans probably will oppose the president simply because they oppose him on pretty much everything. And the leadership in both the House and the Senate has already spoken out against the policy on Cuba. So the fact is, it's not realistic to think that the embargo is going to be lifted by this Congress. But if there are enough Republicans who can see the logic of what the president is doing, it's possible that we might see an end to the travel ban. If there are enough Republicans from Midwestern states who want to sell grain to Cuba, it's possible that we may see a relaxation of the restrictions on agricultural sales.
Well, William Leogrand, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with William Leogrand, who's a professor of government at American University and a specialist in Latin American politics and U.S. foreign policy towards Latin America. He's been a frequent advisor to government and the private sector agencies and has written 5 books, including Our Own Backyard, The United States in Central America, 1977 to 1992. And most recently, he's the co-author of Back Channel to Cuba, The Hidden History of Negotiations Between Washington and Havana. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into the new inclusive capitalism movement. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Edsel, a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times, and he's the author of Power and Money, Writing About Politics, The New Politics of Inequality, and his latest book is The Age of Austerity. He has an op-ed at the New York Times, Can Capitalists Save Capitalism? Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Edsel.
Good to be with you.
And in your New York Times article, Can Capitalists Save Capitalism?, you talk about inclusive capitalism, which, according to its advocates, seeks to make our economic system more equitable, more sustainable, and more inclusive. How much of inclusive capitalism did you detect in President Obama's State of the Union address?
A considerable amount. What is going on, really, is that among Democratic leaders, intellectuals, and economists, there's a growing belief that it's possible to, in a sense, restructure capitalism or actually adopt government policies that don't try to alter the market, but to redirect the market and to change tax policies more for the benefit of working and middle-class people, to penalize companies that fail to reward workers with pay in proportion to their improved productivity, and in general to make the bottom 90%, to give them a larger share of the economic growth that this country is now beginning to experience once again after the 2008-09 recession.
Well, in your article, Thomas Edsel, you quote Mark Carney, the Canadian governor of the Bank of England, explaining his idea of inclusive capitalism thus: just as any revolution eats its children, unchecked market fundamentalism can devour the social capital essential for the long-term dynamism of capitalism itself. So would you accept the premise then that we are now engaged in a kind of unsustainable form of capitalism? I've often thought that because as more and more of our economy becomes financialized and Wall Street controls our economy, they seem to be more about extracting wealth as opposed to creating wealth. And that seems to me to be an indicative of an unsustainable path.
I think that actually capitalism is to a certain extent at a crisis point, because in theory, proponents of capitalism argue that it is the best system to provide benefits to all. But the fact is that really since the mid-1970s, the trend has been for capitalism to increasingly provide benefits only to those at the very top. And while the rest of the population, the middle and especially the bottom, have received very few benefits, their pay has stagnated, if not declined, and their basic living conditions have not improved anywhere near in proportion to which the GNP has grown or that corporate profits have grown, that the system has become distorted. And I think that the idea that there are ways to intervene in this process is a very interesting new development. I'm not sure how successful it will be. The forces that are going on now with globalization, robotics, and technology have hurt the middle class in ways that's very hard to correct. It's possible that government can intervene in ways that will help correct that, but it's not a guarantee.
Well, what was apparent to me in the State of the Union address, Thomas Edsel, was that how dysfunctional and divided our government is. And it seemed just the atmospherics of watching the president and the Republicans in Congress, you couldn't help but notice this vast gap between this talented and visionary president who is trying to do his best and has been hobbled and hamstrung from day one by this obstructionist and hostile Congress, to watch him make these lofty pronouncements and to watch them stone-faced look at him with contempt, knowing that nothing that he's suggesting will even be entertained, let implemented. I just find it tragic.
I agree with you. But I thought, actually, given the reality of Washington, this was one of the better strategic speeches that Obama has given. I thought he laid out a case that made the Republicans, in their silence and in their unwillingness to applaud or to stand up, it really put them in a bad light that he has been unwilling to do until now, the seventh year of his presidency. And I don't think Obama has fully recognized the scope of the opposition he faced and the degree to which they would go tooth and nail against him until now. And I think that the 2014 election results woke him up. It's unfortunate that it took this long to happen.
But it seems to me, though, Thomas Edsel, the takeaway from the 2014 election, two things. One, it was largely bought and paid for by plutocrats like the Koch brothers, and they got what they paid for, total fealty from the Republicans. And they are anti-government zealots, they're libertarians. And many of those people in the hall sitting stony-faced while the president spoke really have an irrational hatred of government. And then on the other side, you have to recognize that the other reason that the Republicans won in this last election was that the Democrats didn't show up. So how do you think the president in any way has inspired Democrats? His poll numbers have gone up. And my suspicion is that the people that have come back into his numbers are, in fact, disillusioned Democrats.
I think you're probably right. I think the purpose of this inclusive capitalism, which has been gaining steam, particularly since the 2014 election results, is to basically provide a means for the Democrats to show up on economic issues. They really, in 2014, had no economic agenda, and they depended a great deal on social issues, the war on women and other matters like that, that have been successful in the past, but they didn't work in this last election. And I think voters want more substance, and the Democrats were not filling that vacuum in the least. And Republicans, if you listen to, they have figured out the rhetoric that's required, and they talk about people having economic problems. May not agree with what their proposals are to solve them, but they are recognizing them. Democrats have, to a certain degree, become excessively dependent on a social, cultural set of issues that at a time like this, when people's pay is not adequate, their agenda is not adequate.
So how do you get past this gridlock, though, Thomas Edsel, where it's apparent that everything that all of these ideas and programs that the president presented to the Congress are dead on arrival, and that they will frustrate him at every turn, and they essentially don't even listen to what he has to say. So you are making the point that he's also, in a sense, embarrassing them. I'm not sure that you can shame them. I think they're quite rigid and immovable. So if shaming them doesn't work, because nothing happens, is this essentially Are we in a holding pattern until we can hope that the American people who've suffered through this next 2 years of gridlock and impasse will change their mind and recognize? I'm not sure in politics people recognize who the real villains are. They just get angry and irrational and usually vote according to their emotions as opposed to according to their intellect.
I'm not sure I agree with you. I think voters receive information, and one of the problems has been that the Democrats and Obama both have failed to provide the information to them on a whole host of subjects, not just information, but actually policies and an agenda that they can understand. I think this marks the first attempt by the Democrats to lay out a contrasting agenda on economic issues to the Republican Party. And the more that they are really, I think, not looking to enact anything over the next 2 years, but toward the 2016 election, presidential and congressional. And the idea is to try to establish more firmly in the public mind what their choices are, to provide the information and so that the public can make a more intelligent decision. But the public doesn't pay great attention to politics, and it basically receives information from the various sources. Insofar as the Democrats and President Obama are sources, they have been woefully inadequate in their efforts even to develop an agenda. I think they now may be moving towards resolving that liability on their part. But it's been a long process, and we'll see how it works. It's just beginning, and I think the State of the Union speech is part of it. There are these other studies and reports by members of Congress and by liberal think tanks that all seem to be pointing in the same direction on economic policy. Insofar as that begins to take, in theory, the public will begin to absorb some of this information and have a better sense of what their choices are on election day. They have not really had that knowledge and information provided to them in recent elections.
So, Thomas Edsel, given that our politics are so flagrantly money-driven, and it's worth noting that most of the Republican candidates for president have already paid homage and voyaged to Kansas to sort of, stoop down and kiss the ring of the Koch brothers. So it's pretty clear that they're all after their money and money from Sheldon Adelson and other billionaires. And then on the Democratic side, we already know that they have somewhat compromised their message or at least confused their base, because they get their votes from ordinary middle class and working Americans, but they get a lot of their money from Wall Street, and they have something of a mixed message. So can you navigate us through this? Are there inclusive capitalists on the good side and reactionary libertarian type of capitalists on the other side?
Actually, this concept of inclusive capitalism has substantial support from capitalists. Certainly not the Koch brothers or others, but they held a conference in London last May, and the number of CEOs who attended was quite impressive. In fact, was worrisome to the Democratic left. You're right about the issue about when the crunch comes on Wall Street questions, for example, taxing hedge fund income and capital gains. Although it was pretty striking that Obama is willing to raise capital gains taxes from 23.8% to 28%, which is a direct challenge basically to Wall Street, which was where capital gains income is very important. But there's no question that money is a big problem, and it's more of a problem really on the Democratic side because it creates a real conflict of interest.
But is there any sort of debate that you think is going to come out of this? Are we going to start talking about the idea? I mean, are American capitalists going to come forth? I know some of them, like Warren Buffett and Bill Gates and Bill Gross, have talked about income inequality. It would seem to me that, unfortunately, you more or less have to have a successful capitalist tell us that there's something wrong with capitalism.
I think that, well, I think that there are a substantial number of capitalists who believe that the current system is distorted, and even though they are profiting from it, that they are endangering their own source of revenue by allowing things to get so become so unequal and to allow so many of their prospective clients and customers from having the income to be good consumers. It's like the Henry Ford theory that he wanted to pay his workers enough so they could buy a Model T. I mean, not all capitalists are blind to their longer-term interests. And, well, we'll see. It's hard to predict what's going to happen.
Well, you know, you've made the point, and I think it's a very strong one, Thomas Edsel, that the Democrats have been absolutely lacking in a narrative, and now they seem to be getting a narrative. And I was wondering who's going to take the bit between their teeth and run with it and really start explaining to the American people that it's not necessary for people to be, you know, struggling. You can have, as President Kennedy said many decades ago, a rising tide raises all boats. There's a certain logic to the idea of more equality, more income, more consumption, as opposed to hoarding wealth and hiring a bunch of politicians to protect your privilege.
Well, who's going to do it? I mean, one, Obama while he's president, but two, the candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination. And one of the leading or the most detailed examples of this inclusive capitalism proposal has been put together by this, was published by the Center for American Progress, which is the home for many Clintonites between the elections. It sponsored and published this document. The document was half written by Larry Summers, who's very close to the Clintons. John Podesta was the founder and ran the Center for American Progress. He is now joining the Hillary Clinton campaign. And Nedra Tannen is the current head of it, and she is a former Hillary Clinton aide. So it's possible that this will become the working document of the Hillary for President campaign. Don't know, but we'll see. But it certainly has a lot of Clinton fingerprints on it. And she would be the one, in theory, to carry this kind of message forward. Her goal has been, one of her goals is, that her claims is that she has strong appeal to working-class voters. She needs an agenda to follow through on that. So when you ask who's going to carry this forward, you have the president in office now and whoever the Democratic nominee will be in 2016, plus the leaders of Congress.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, sure. Thomas Edsel.
My pleasure. Thanks.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Edsel, who's a professor of journalism at Columbia University. His column on demographic and strategic trends in American politics appears every Wednesday in the New York Times, and he's the author of Power and Money, Writing About Politics, The New Politics of Inequality, and his latest book is The Age of Austerity. He has an op-ed at the New York Times, Can Capitalists Save Capitalism? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.